frequency region from 30 megs to 3 gigahertz is with a dipole tuned to each one of those frequencies of measurement and less than 30 decibels above a microvolt onto that dipole. And I believe this is one of those cage dipole-like things where you can adjust it for each one of the frequencies. I'm a little bit amazed that the measurement is made at 10 meters, because much of the measurements that are made for the Part 15 that we have to follow is at 3 meters, which is close to 10 feet. Is there any possibility you're confusing 10 feet with 10 meters? Because 10 meters is 30 feet. Are you telling me your chamber has, in one dimension, 30 feet of range? Over to you, Glenn.
Unbelievable as it sounds, that is the standard. As a matter of fact, if you want to see a beautiful version of this chamber, if anybody ever needs to use one, I can tell you where it's located. Underwriters Laboratories has one right up in the Melville area. And you can go visit there. It's a beautiful chamber. You walk right inside there. You could drive a tractor trailer in there, dude. It's a beauty. Now, as you get higher in frequency, remember, as I said, this is done in groups. As you start stepping up in frequency, like I said, there's a notched step. As you move up, I believe it's to the 100, near the 2-meter band, the level actually gets lower. It goes down to 20 dB microvolts. So you got to even be lower. Now, when you get up into, there's a 1 to 3 gig area, somewhere inside there where there's an overlap in the standard. And what they do is, the chamber actually changes. And now this is probably where you're talking about, in that 1 gigahertz area where you've been probably doing a lot of measurements, Dick. Now, what they have is a 3-meter standard. And the 3-meter standard is actually measured completely different. And some of that can be done in open air. It doesn't have to be inside the closed chamber area, and totally different criteria. And I'm sure you're probably already familiar with that standard itself. But that's the 3-meter standard. Back over to you, Dick.
Okay. We've now got it defined in a way that is somewhat traceable to the Bureau. And once Andy tells us how far away his FM radio is bombed, I can make some rough approximations as to whether or not his lighting is exceeding the radiated spec. And by what he's telling me, I have reason to believe he is failing the conductive spec within his shop that contains that lighting. Sounds like Bill's is failing too. Andrew, with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with one more tidbit of information on that, Dick.
You got it, Glenn.
Now, if you remember the wording that I was using, the FCC is the governing body. The radiated and conducted standards are the standards, but they're not the hard law. Now, this is the sticking point. What happens is this. Because these devices radiate, it all goes back to the law, which says, thou shalt not create interference. Okay? So now, if you become the person or the operator or the manufacturer who is deemed causing interference, you must fix it. Now, if you go back and you say, okay, I'm creating interference, the FCC's guideline says I've got to meet the radiated and the conducted standards. Okay, so you go back and you meet those. But that's not a guarantee. You come back, and even though you've met them, if you're still creating interference, you may even have to go to limits that are lower. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, this reminds me a little bit of the broadband over power line type situation. The loose wording is you shouldn't be creating interference to other co-located, frequency-located services. And I don't know whether or not they've boiled that down to a fixed number of microvolts per meter, dB microvolt on a dipole, or whatever. I wonder if you're familiar with that one, Glenn. Go ahead.
Not so much. Most of the stuff I've done has been dealing with, you know, a lot of systems and, you know, creating things that have to be sold internationally. Here inside the United States, it's such a mess with radiated emissions and all this stuff that's all over the place. The sloppiest equipment I've seen in the world is here. But there's no way you can sell this stuff over into Europe. So you have to meet all the European standards. And then they hold you to nobody will, unless you're certified that you've met all these standards, no one will even allow you to sell anything in Europe. So the good news is, because people are starting to follow the standards on a lot of the industrial and consumer products, you're starting to see a lot better equipment. But occasionally stuff is sneaking through on some of the leading edge stuff, you know, like maybe some of these LED drivers, crappy power supplies, mole warts and stuff like that, you got to keep your eye on that stuff because it can sneak out there and bite you, if you know what I mean. And let's face it, as hams, we're the people who should even complain about it and, cause these manufacturers to clean up their act. KC2, QIQ.
I want to make a comment on that, Dick.
Okay, Andy. Yeah, one of the tough European standards is ETSI, E-T-S-I, which is a governing body which I think is more strict than many of the FCC rules. W2CDL, K2IW.
Yeah, see, exactly what Glenn is saying is what my concern is. I'm not even sure if these fixtures have ever been tested for emissions. I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if, let's say they manufacture 100 of them, and out of the 100, they only check a certain percentage to see if it meets specification. Let's say 10%. What happens to the others? Because I've seen this before, where not everyone is checked, and maybe, as Glenn says, you know, some of them just get by because they never tested. They figured that, well, you know, this certain batch passed the test of admissions. They're all going to pass. Well, that's not the case. It never works out that way. I believe because I'll make some tests. I'll make some measurements. We'll determine if this is exceeding the standard of the specification for emissions, and if it does, then I will make a complaint. I'll call the manufacturer and I'll let them know. Let's see what they can do about it. Because I have to go out and re-retrofit my fixture because it's not meeting a spec that's supposed to be met. I think you would agree with this one, Dick.
This is K2KE. Why would I comment?
I sure do, Andy. Go ahead, Mel.
Andy brought up a good point. I don't think a lot of them are checked. Let's go back to the incandescent lamp, and you will get one of these light dimmers, you know, these variable controls that you can dim your light. Some of them are brutal, the amount of noise that they create. And if you have a neighbor that has one, and you're a ham radio operator, you've got trouble. You're not going to do very much in the HF band. And you take others, and they're quiet. They don't make any kind of noise at all. So I think it's pot luck. You just got to, if you have a situation like that, get several of them and see which one works well, because there's no specification, and I don't think there's any control over it, Dick, over.
Yeah, I had an incandescent lamp in my living room 10 years or so ago with a dimmer circuit built into it with a variable control, and I noticed that whenever I used that dimmer circuit, my television set in the same room connected with a good coax cable to an antenna on the roof, and my house is 300 feet above sea level in Huntington, and I have essentially direct line of sight to the Empire State Building. On channels 2, 4, and 5, the amount of interference from that dimmer circuit with a good strong signal, I was probably getting 50 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, carrier-to-noise ratio into that TV set, and the noise from that dimmer was strong enough 15 or 20 feet away to create an annoying amount of interference on the television set, and I stopped using it. Well, lucky for me, it failed, and I bypassed it entirely. So how that ever got past any of the standards is an interesting thing. Seems like Glenn is telling us these are recommended standards, but not necessarily the law. The law is it shouldn't create interference. Well, that's a little bit vague. To a ham radio operator with a receiver that's good for a tenth of a microvolt or a quarter of a microvolt, his definition of an interference is very different from a guy with a hi-fi set or a guy with a over-the-air television broadcast receiver. The level of tolerance could be very, very different, probably 20 dB difference in some cases. One of the things that I got to mention to you, Mel, is that I will have to leave you guys at 11 o'clock tonight. It's something I've got to go do tonight. And you guys will probably continue beyond that. Let's go over to Bill, if he's available, for our space report. After that, we should start going over to Mel's mailbag. WS2N, what has NASA been doing? What's been going on in space, Bill? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet. Maybe Bill got called away. Are you there, Bill? Okay, we kept him waiting a little bit too long. Mel, what's your mailbag been like this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick?
Go ahead, Andy.
I think there was another station trying to get in, kind of weak. Maybe you had a comment before you closed this topic. I thought somebody was trying to get in.
Yeah, somebody that sounded like IKY, very weak. Mr. IKY, question mark, are you still there? Doesn't sound like he is. And Mel, are you there with the write-in questions? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yes, this is K2KEY. I thought somebody else wanted to join us. I also thought I heard a somewhat weak signal in there previous, and fairly noisy, but there was somebody in there. Let's take one more standby. I hate to, you know, miss somebody. This is K2KEY. Go ahead, please, the station that wanted to join us. I guess he gave up, Dick. All right, anyhow, yes, we get mail. Like the old song goes. The number of questions, I have to just pass over. A heck of a lot of them, and I just have no way of answering them, and I don't think you can either. I'm just going to rubber stamp your name in this situation, Dick, but I'm sure you agree with me. So I'm looking for ones that make a little bit of at ease and have interest. Are very hard to sort these out. But here's one that's been coming up a few times. A number of the newer hams, poorer guys especially, want to know about using light bulbs, incandescent light bulbs as a dummy load, and what's the proper way to use them. I have some ideas on it, but I'll toss it out to you first, Dick. Over.
Yeah, incandescent light bulbs are a beautiful dummy load for an HF transmitter, maybe even a lower VHF transmitter. A 100-watt light bulb, when it's fully lit, is running at 120 volts and drawing a little bit less than 1 ampere. That means it's presenting an impedance of around 100 ohms. Let's see if I got that number right. 100 volts, 1 ampere, yeah. Very close to 120 ohms. Which is only a little bit more than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a 50-ohm transmitter. Another very interesting factor of an incandescent bulb is that the filament made out of tungsten has a rather high positive thermal temperature coefficient of resistance. So therefore, when that bulb is at full brilliance and it's giving you 120 ohms of loading, you put your ohm meter across the base of a unlit 100-watt light bulb, incandescent light bulb, and you're going to measure something less than 10 ohms. It's got that much difference. Now you have an understanding of why a bulb will sometimes pop when you first turn it on. It has something like 10 ohms of resistance when it's cold. Therefore, it's drawing something like 10 amperes when you first turn it on. More than a kilowatt flows into that bulb for the first few milliseconds until the filament comes up to speed. So, as you adjust that light bulb at slightly less than full brilliance, you will pass to a point where it is a 50-ohm load. A nearly 100-watt, nearly 50-ohm load is a darn good load for a transmitter. The transmitter will be very happy with that. Most tube-type transmitters have very little problem holding, taking care of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, whether the resistance is too low or too high. I will admit the more modern solid-state rigs, many of them can't tolerate 2-to-1, so first lighting up the light bulb could be a little bit of a problem. And maybe it's the way that a person could have a single-pole double-throw switch where he throws the switch in one direction, 110 volts is thrown to the bulb to light it up, and then he throws it in the other direction where it becomes a load for the transmitter. As long as the transmitter is turned on soon enough, while the bulb is still hot.
Repeater, timeout.
Hopefully you'll connect it, you'll catch it at nearly the 50-ohm point, and after that the solid-state transmitter can continue to fire into that light bulb. And the light bulb itself is a beautiful indicator. The brilliance of the bulb will tell you when you're tuning up your transmitter whether or not you're going in the right direction. As you go to smaller and smaller light bulbs, like 60 watts, 30 watts, and whatever, the internal resistance starts getting kind of high. And so when it's cold, yes, some of those are going to be near nearer to 50 ohms. But as they heat up and the resistance increases, it's going to be a little bit problematic. A guy who's got a little bit of experimental nature to him, for almost any reasonable transmitter, should be able to find a combination of various kinds of incandescent bulbs, which will act as a good dummy load. For a very, very small transmitter, a number 47 pilot light with the right resistor across it would be a not bad indicating dummy load. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger.
W2RIY.
K2KEY. I got involved with this little experiment a few years ago. Not more than a few years ago.
So recognized?
Because I had some questions about how the loading controls kept changing as the bulb, as they came up with the power from, say, the drive power. Of course, using the old two-pipe transmitters, you could do a lot of these types of things. I measured, as Dick says, the coil resistance of a 100-watt light bulb is approximately 1/10 of the full brilliant resistance. I also measured that even when the lamp is lit, there's approximately a half a microhenry of inductance. So this inductance, I said, gee, how do I do this? What do I do? Because if I measured the SWR, I saw I had a fairly high SWR with the lamp. And it varied, I should say, as you move, you know, change the loading and the drive. Let me let it drop, and I'll tell you a very good way of fixing this up and make yourself a nice, classy dummy load for a 100-watt rig that'll be very cheap. Okay, so what I did, I got this idea. I said, you know, I took two 110-volt, 120-volt light bulb, 100-watters. I put them, each one to the transmitter's, you know, center terminal, the other one to the ground, in series with a tuning condenser. I think it was about 1,200 PF tuning condenser. And what I was able to do then, I was able to tune out that reactance with that tuning condenser. So in other words, the whole thing is in series. You go from the center of your connector to a 100-watt light bulb, through the capacitor, through another 100-watt light bulb, and to ground. And with this, I was able to actually get a 1-to-1 SWR then reading. So theoretically, what was happening, let me tell you how I went a little further. Just let me drop. Theoretically, the bulb's resistance would have been somewhere around, 275, 300, I don't know, somewhere up like at full brilliance. So the SWR would have been like 1.44. So when measured, of course, by this system, I was able to tune that out and bring the SWR actually down to 1-to-1. So this is a very elegant way of making a very simple, very effective dummy load with two 100-watt light bulbs, and all you need is a variable capacitor, and you can find that it'll even work real well on the newer rigs because you can maintain a very low SWR. It won't fold back the power. Go ahead, Dick.
If you don't have the variable cap, it'll cost more than a real dummy load, WB2EAV.
Okay, that capacitor could be a little bit of a problem to find. Transmitting rated capacitors, what I think Mr. Gellinger is telling us. But under normal circumstances, you go out and try to find a 100-watt dummy load resistor, that's a pretty large, low inductance dummy load, pretty large, hard to find, expensive item. Whereas light bulbs with a little bit of craftiness can do the job very nicely. Ed, you want to add to that? Mr. EAV, K2LIW.
No, just wanted to say, if you don't happen to have a suitable variable in your junk box, I don't think buying it would be variable. You can buy commercial dummy loads. They're not that bad. These days, a fairly large transmitter-type variable capacitor is probably $50, if you can find it at all. Back to Dick, WB2EAV.
At the 300-watt level, I mean at the 365 picofarad, at the 100-watt level of a transmitter, I think you might not arc over the very common 365 picofarad air variable capacitors that used to be popular back in my day. Yeah, they're getting kind of rare now also. But many of the AM radios, tube-type, tabletop AM radios, contained a triple bank or double bank or a triple bank of 365 picofarad air variable capacitors. And I think they would tolerate 100 watts. What do you think, Ed? Go ahead.
Right, you.
Something I do, just one sec. I really don't think they would take it. They were just made that the spacing would guarantee that the plates wouldn't contact under any kind of stress and nothing more. And I believe the standard is a 365 for the RF amp and something like a 250 for the local oscillator. Dick, you should pick up that other guy.
Yeah, the other guy was Mel. I'll bet you used a 365 tube-type radio variable capacitor. As long as you choose one where the plates don't touch, I bet it worked like a charm. Is that true, Mel?
Exactly. You can see plenty of them. I saw them laying on the table the last ham fest I went to. They had plenty of them laying around because they were made like schmooze. They just kept coming. And so there are plenty of this still around, surplus. And I used it on a 100-watt rig, and it worked fine. I used it on, in fact, I used to load, check out my, that time, my Johnson Viking 2 rig. I'm going to, this will really date it. And that's what I used. And you know something? My previous radios that I built, my rigs that I built were in the 50 to the 100-watt range, Dick. My tuning condensers were really salvaged tuning condensers. Many of them from things like you just mentioned, from radios. I didn't have any real source of, you know, really great transmitting parts back in my early days. Everything was salvaged. I mean, the tubes I salvaged were from amplifiers that my uncle worked at a place that had jukeboxes, so he saved me some 6L6s. Everything was scrounged, and I know that the tuning capacitors that I used were definitely scrounged from radios I found in the street, over.
Now, let me give you a quick mental calculation I just did, Mel, and Ed. A 1,000-watt transmitter into a 50-ohm load is producing something less than 300 volts of RMS voltage. I think a tube-type 365 picofarad air variable capacitor that's in good shape, where the plates are not touching and there's not a whole lot of dust, I think there's a moderately good chance that those plates will not arc over at 300 volts RMS. What do you think, Ed? Mr. EAV, K2RIW?
I agree with you 100% with one teensy-weensy little question. It's a variable capacitor. When you start off, your visuar is going to be around 20 to 1 before you null it out.
Okay, you got to be a little bit smart in the way you use it. Or even if it arcs over when you first press down the key, you set the variable capacitor to a different place and press down the key again. You and I would very rapidly find the right tuning position. Ed, go ahead.
Knowing is half the battle. Just don't forget or it's going to get real ugly.
Wrong.
I don't think it's real ugly. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. The full brilliance of the bulbs, the two 100-watt light bulbs, without the variable, if you just look at the two light bulbs, the bulb resistance will be approximately around 275 ohms or so. In fact, if I remember, I measured it. I went through how I measured that. I remember that. It was around 280 some odd ohms. So that means that it would start out with approximately an SWR of about 1 to 144, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, while we're at it, let me mention the great value of a roughly 100-watt light bulb. Quite often, we're testing a suspicious transmitter, suspicious receiver, suspicious chunk of electronics. That if the chunk of electronics has really got a fault inside, it might represent a dead short. You plug a dead short into the 110-volt line, you're going to reset the circuit breaker, you're going to blow a fuse, you're going to create some smoke and flames. If the suspicious chunk of electronics was put in series with a 100-watt light bulb, if at worst your suspicious chunk of electronics was a dead short, nothing bad would happen. The light bulb will simply light. If the light bulb doesn't light, then you know your suspicious chunk of electronics is absorbing most of the voltage and it's not a short circuit. So as a first test of a very suspicious chunk of electronics, that light bulb is a beautiful safety valve that doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to reset a circuit breaker. You don't have to replace fuses. You don't have to do anything to correct it when you're first doing the early tests of your suspicious chunk of electronics. So a poor man's safety valve, a poor man's dummy load, properly used light bulbs can be really beautiful. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters on this one.
Correct. This is K2KEY. I've had a light bulb like that with clip leads and a 60-watt light bulb set up like that for years. Because let me tell you something. The rule of thumb is, the fuse is blown. You put a fuse in, if you had one thing that was shorted in there causing the fuse to blow, you just compounded and added something else that is going to be, that's going to be a failure. So, especially with these old power transformers, and then some of this equipment you pick up, the word to the wise is, put that bulb in series before you apply the plug directly into the wall. Because if you blow those power transformers, any of that on there, some of that old equipment, the receivers and all, the transformers are not replaceable very easy. In fact, you may abandon trying to restore that antique radio and all if you destroy the power transformer. They're very hard and very costly if you can find them. And I'll tell you, I had that experience. I had a wrecked, literally a wrecked receiver. And I told this guy about it, and he asked me what model. It was a model of a helicraft. I said, it's been pretty well stripped. He says, what about the power transformer? I said, it's in there. He says, I'll give you, he says, how much you want for the repair? I says, well, what would it? He says, name a price. He says, I got to want to restore one. He says, I cannot get that power transformer. So that's a word to the wise. You got a blown fuse, do what Dick just said, over.
Okay. That's a fun troubleshooting procedure. And once again, any of these chunks of electronics that we open them up and something is not working right, your very first step is to measure every one of the voltages of the power supply regulator assembly. That's the most common point of failure. And you've heard the story many times from me of where I was repairing a radio that I borrowed from Harry Dannell, W2HD. I forget what his call letters used to be, TMZ or something like that. Anyhow, I wanted to repair it for him after I had borrowed it from him. It was low in gain in the IF strip. The S meter wasn't moving very well. I chased my tail for a week. Every one of the stages in the IF strip were all low in gain. Couldn't figure out what was going on. Finally found out that the standard reference 6-volt regulator was wrong, and every other power supply was therefore also low. So the poor radio was running on low voltages everywhere. I would have saved myself an awful lot of time had I measured the voltages the first time I opened up the cabinet. Okay, what's the next letter you got, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, by the way, WF2N, he has signed in early, I see here. Did you stand by for him in his state report, Dick?
I sure did, but let me do it again. WS2N, I wonder if you've come back. K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, he either fell asleep or he got called away, Mel. So go ahead with your next letter if that's what you'd like to do.
Okay, in keeping with, like I say, trying to answer straightforward, simple questions, and especially emphasizing newcomers to ham radio, here's another one that also pretty much gets this quite often. Recently, I think it's getting more prevalent because maybe it's a reflection on what is happening to our economic situation and the price of secondhand equipment. Many questions come in as to what is a guideline for purchasing secondhand equipment. In other words, do you take the original price and year two, three, four, 5 years old, is there a formula for coming up with what, if the radio should be, you know, worth, because you see such, on the same piece of equipment, such a variation sometimes in the price of, you know, what they are offering it for one of these sites, the websites or whatever, you know, go to where they have these traders and things like that. What is the rule of thumb? What do you think you should pay for a radio, let's say, that is, well, hopefully working, over.
My first guess on this one, Mel, is there is no fixed price. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Certain pieces of equipment that are very well respected might sell at 50% of their original cost 15 years later. Other pieces of equipment that are not so well respected might sell at 10% of their original cost 3 years later. However, I'm going to give you an example of one that's very prevalent to me. Right now, you're listening to one of my favorite rigs, Kenwood TS711A. It's a 2-meter all-mode, a 1 to 30 watt output with a variable button knob on the front panel where you can continuously change the power output between 1 and 30 watts. It's only got 30 memories, but it transmits FM, upper sideband, lower sideband, CW, 30 memories. Also has something called digital DCS, whatever, digital code squelch. It's got a number of features. It's got a, I think it usually comes with a built-in PL board. I don't think that's an option that you have to add. An awful nice radio. Has a built-in 110-volt power supply, so you can run it on 110 volts or on 12 volts. My modern-day standard is a little bit on the bulky side. It's a desktop rig. You could use it mobile, but it's a little bit large for mobile. I guess it's about 4 inches wide, 4 inches high, about 10 inches wide, about 12 inches deep. And it probably weighs 20 pounds. Very well constructed. By my standards, let me drop. It's got the world's best frequency synthesizer. The frequency synthesizer covers 140 to 150 megahertz inclusive when you remove the frequency limiting diodes inside. And the frequency synthesizer moves in 10 hertz steps. Very, very clean synthesizer. 10 hertz steps, 140 to 150 megahertz inclusive. An equivalent rig today, same approximate power output, same number of features, probably has a little more memory, maybe, this thing's also got tunable IF, separate RF gain control, AF gain control, in the sideband mode, mic gain control, power output control, squelch setting on the front panel, tunable IF, receiver incremental tuning, transmitter incremental tuning, memories on those functions. Lots of very nice features. I think that rig sold brand new in the $600 category. Nowadays, even though that particular rig, which was late 70s, that makes it what? 25 years old. If someone sold you that rig for $350 today, in my opinion, you're getting a bargain. Because an equivalent rig today is at least $1,200 to $1,500. That's an oldie but goodie. I like that one. There are people who fell in love with the old Kenwood 520. Many versions of it have a built-in power supply, 100-watt sideband rig, 80 through 10 meters. I think it goes down to 80. It doesn't go down to 160. I'm looking at the front panel of mine right now. And, yeah, 80 meters is the lowest. I think there are versions of it that go down. The Kenwood 450, the Kenwood 840 and 940 series, very popular rigs. And I think they're selling for, on the surplus market, numbers like $300 and $400. And the equivalent today, brand new, is well above $1,500, approaching $2,000. Let me drop. You do a little bit of shopping around. Talk to your buddies as to what their favorite rig is. Don't be discouraged by the fact that the rig was originally sold 10, 15, 20, 25, or 30 years ago. Certain models hold their value. People love them. They got nice characteristics. Many of them are Kenwoods, in my opinion. ICOM, not quite as many of them, have people fallen in love with quite that deeply. Same with Yaesu. Not quite as many of them have people fallen in love with to quite that degree. So Kenwood made a beautiful radio 20 years ago. Many of their models are real keepsakes. And the average guy, when he buys a used rig, he thinks he wants to know the complete heritage, its history, who owned it, how many people, how did they treat it, were they a smoker, is the front panel clean looking, does it come in the original box, does it have the owner's manual. Many of those things that people consider important are not important. When you've got somebody like Andy, WA2CDL, who runs these tune-up clinics at the Limark Hamfest, who can fix anything, as long as the majority of the parts are there. I don't care if the rig's been thrown down a flight of stairs and the front panel is dented. 95% of the parts to make that rig work are there. Except for the power transformer, there is no one component in there that's very expensive. There's a slight exception to that. Some of the modern day rigs, if the main microprocessor needed replacement, I'll admit that that could be difficult to find and expensive. But with that exception, and rarely does the main microprocessor fail, with that exception, there's no one component in there that's very expensive. And some of the smarter guys will buy a rig on the flea market that is advertised as being non-working. As long as you got a little bit of nerve, buying a non-working rig, you can get it at 5% of the original cost. And in many cases, there's only one very simple thing that's in there that needs repair to make it working. Of course, there's an exception. If somebody was a real brutal guy and went in there and did a whole lot of damage and made a whole lot of changes trying to find out what was wrong, a bull in the china shop, yeah, I'll admit that fixing that kind of a rig would be difficult. But those are rare cases. If the guy will let you open up the front cover up...
Repeater, timeout.
If the owner will let you open up the top cover of a non-working rig, you can find that out real fast. You look at those printed circuit boards, you'll know right away when somebody else has been fooling around with them. So these are some of my criteria when I'm buying a rig. Almost everything I own is used. I don't like buying brand new prices on automobiles or ham rigs. I really like used equipment, because with the right philosophy, everything is fixable. I don't need the original shipping box and the wrapping plastic and the owner's manual and the service manual and knowing whether or not it had one previous owner who treated it with tender loving care or it had five previous owners. Those are minor details. In my opinion, not everybody thinks the way I do, but that philosophy works for me. Mel, I bet you, has a lot of used equipment, very few brand new pieces of equipment. Let's find out what his philosophy is and the philosophy of the Kings County Radio Club. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Jeff, this is K2KEY, everything more or less here. I literally salvaged the radio that I'm using right now, also at Kenwood 271. I actually took it out of the garbage pail. It was really just going out for the trash. I salvaged it and, yeah, needed an output transistor. That was all that was wrong with it, but you missed one point, Dick. In fact, well, let's put it this way, even my power supply here, the power supply I'm using here is a homebrew power supply, switching power supply, that was basically built from computers, a thrown out computer that I found in the street, a number of them, and used basically the make it work quietly. A lot of these power supplies, of course, I just write off, you know, if you take them out of a computer or whatever, they are a little bit on the noisy side into the radios. They do need work to clean them up, so I just salvaged the parts out of them, and I wound up using XQ2 FOD, our friend Mornwick, that design of a power supply, straightforward. Basically used his outline there and with some, you know, little changes here and everything to more or less modernize what is available today. And there it is. That's the power supply. So you're listening to Everything Salvage right now. Let me let it drop and then I'll make a comment about this. Yes, there is a problem. Let me put to you this problem. You mentioned Kenwood otherwise. I have an 830 that was brand new. It was taken out of the carton, and in some place upstate New York, it was plugged into the 220. How they got into a regular, they said it was a regular receptacle that had been rewired or wired wrong for 220, and bang, killed the power transformer. At the new radio, the person that owned it, honest enough to tell Kenwood what the situation was, Dick, what happened, and sent it back, and they gave him a ridiculous price to repair it. So, went back into the cart and laid in the closet until finally they were moving. They asked me if I was interested in purchasing it, and told me the whole story, very honest, very up to the, very nice gentleman that I dealt with. He, you know, none of this underhanded or things or acting like he didn't know what's going on. He gave me this straight story on it. If I tell you what they hit me for the part to buy that transformer, why did I buy the transformer? Well, I couldn't take the one apart that's in there because it's welded together. You know, they're not the repairable like used to be years ago where you can, you know, take the screws out and separate the thing and play with the windings. So let me let it drop. The only reason I say there is some caution, because if you do go to these companies for parts, they like sometimes to take a little advantage. In fact, that's what I did. I called them up and I said it was a little outrageous what you charged me for a power transformer. I said, I have a power transformer, unfortunately not physically the size to get into the case. So I took the transformer from you. And see, this is the point. In other words, what do you, where do you draw the line? What is the depreciation if, for instance, the rig is brand new and it's, and you, how much would you give for a rig? In other words, what is the depreciation from the day it's purchased? Similar to an automobile, I can tell you that, you know, what the blue book is from year to year on an automobile, but I don't think there's anything like that for amateur radio equipment, over.
No, absolutely not. Again, it's the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. A guy selling him a piece of equipment, if he's smart, he'll look at the want ads and find out what that particular model number is selling for and ask a price in that vicinity. And there are certain pieces of equipment that people really fall in love with, and 20 years later, it's selling at 60% or so of the original selling price, which is still a good price when you include the inflation of modern-day money. And some pieces of equipment are selling at the 10 and 20% of what an equivalent piece of brand-new equipment would cost you today. At the pace of brand-new equipment, in some cases, it's got so darn many horns and whistles and so many tiny little buttons on it, and such a great big learning curve to go through the owner's manual to figure out how to program the darn thing, that it's not necessarily an advantage. One of the real oldie but goodies is an ICOM IC2AT handy talkie. 2.2 million of them have been manufactured. I own 4 or 5 of them. And I use them every single day, one or two of them. That's a 1985 piece of equipment. Or is it 1975? 1985 is the approximate year of manufacture. That's 20 some odd years old. Thumb wheel switch programmable, very simple. The only complaint I've got is that it doesn't have a built-in PL encoder. You have to add a separate printed circuit board in there to do that. Something like 3 or 4 watts output in the high power mode. Not super compact handy talkie, no scanning function. Nice and simple. There were times when that particular rig, which sold brand new for $160 or so, there were times when one of those on the surplus market in very good working condition will sell for numbers like $40, $50, $30. I've seen ridiculous prices on those. Very reliable rig. The two of them that I own, one of them...
Repeater, timeout.
One of them has been dropped from the 100-foot level of my tower onto the lawn. Another one was dropped from the 60-foot level of a tower onto a blacktop. And both of them survived. The battery on one of them got smashed, but they survived and are still running today. Very rugged piece of equipment. So there's no easy definition. In the case of an automobile, there's a fixed percentage that the automobile depreciates each year. Radio equipment, some of them depreciate faster, some of them depreciate slower, depending on how good the original design was and how many people fell in love with it. And you go to the Fox Tango Users Club, so to speak, a website, and you can get all kinds of data on many of these Kenwood rigs. And there's similar websites for ICOM and Yaesu and some of the other major brands. I am curious as to how expensive that power transformer was on that Kenwood rig, Mel. And it's too bad that you couldn't take the old one apart. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. 200 and I think it was $45 plus shipping, deck over.
That is a bit pricey, but that is a piece of well-loved equipment that in the big picture, from your point of view, it was worth it because it was sold as a non-working piece of equipment, and you probably got it at a fairly good price. Overall, I think you came out ahead. What do you think, Mel?
K2YO.
YO, recognize Mel first?
Well, yes, because it was brand new. Actually, it was out of the carton, plugged in, blown up, went back in the carton, went to Kenwood, came back again, never removed from the carton because it was still never, you know, never considered doing anything more with it, and stuck in the closet, laid in the closet for maybe 10 years, 15 years, who the heck knows? I forgot what year it was manufactured. And I bought it very reasonable, and because of its, first of all, its age, and number two, it was non-working. But I said, gee, brand new. Could it be so impossible to fix? I mean, I said to myself, I can't conceive anything in there that is not repairable, like you said. So I said, okay, I'm going to take a shot at it. And yeah, the power transformer is made in such a way, you know how the construction of transformers now? No, you don't separate them anymore. No way. They're all welded together. It's done with everything today. I replaced the motor in the dishwasher here. And the motor in the dishwasher, also the case is welded together. I was just looking at how the motor was constructed. It's a one-shot. It's welded together. Not that I ever thought of, you know, taking the motor really apart and repairing it. But I noticed there's no more screws involved in any of these pieces, so the transformers stick over.
Yeah, I guess your washing machine motor, somebody let the smoke out, which means they don't work anymore. They got to have smoke inside. Mr. K2YL, is it Yankee Lemur or Yankee Oscar? Over to you, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
And the Yankee has a comment when he's done.
Roger. YO, YL.
Good evening, Dick and the Nat. I'm deep in Queens in a computer room. Am I holding the repeater up okay?
Reasonably good. Go right ahead. What's your call letters and name?
Call sign is Kilo 2 Yankee Oscar. Name is Bernie. I just wanted to comment on finding out prices. If you go back to your college macroeconomics or microeconomics, we actually have a good way of determining fair market value on a lot of things, and that's called eBay. I don't know if most people are aware. You can look up what past items have sold for, and based on those past items, get a feeling of what the market is bearing at any given time. I've done this with a number of pieces of test equipment that I wanted, but I had no idea what it was worth. Once I've got an idea on eBay as to what they're going for, then I can search around on the web and see if somebody's got one at a reasonable price close to that, or maybe slightly above it if they're willing to back it and warrant it. So just a thought I'd throw out, K2YO.
Good information, Bernie. Yep. eBay is a very good worldwide way of finding out what something is worth. In the old days, you could use the yellow sheets. In the older days, you could use the wanted section of QST magazine. Now that almost everybody sells things online, those two sources are not quite as good anymore. Mr. Gallander, how do you find out what the value of things are? Mr. EAV, K2LIW.
Well, eBay is my preferred way of doing things like that. I've done that, been there, done that. But I had a comment from Mel about why make things like motors and transformers terrible now. Should I go ahead?
Sounds good. Go right ahead, Ed.
Long time ago, in a galaxy far away, when I was a college student, driving my father's car, and my father and I shared the philosophy of never buying anything new. We had a problem with a starter motor. It was a repairable starter motor. And we would jack the car up, climb under it, pull it out, take it apart, repair it, put it back together. And about a month later, it would act up again. After about four of these episodes, we said, the heck with it.
and put it in a, you know, professionally rebuilt one. And I believe the moral of the story is we're dealing with heavy users. The reason when they start to act up is because the insulation and the wiring is breaking down. Can do band-aid fixes, but it's ultimately a waste of time. And they may have decided there is no percentage in repairing it. It may not be anything, it may not be any huge conspiracy to get bucks. Dick?
Yeah, that's a little bit of an exception to the rules, though, as I see it, Ed. I also had a similar experience. Had a Ford, was it a Ford or an Oldsmobile? Oldsmobile automobile. I didn't know it, but there was a couple of arced paths inside of the spark distributor mechanism. So therefore, the engine was extremely hard to start one day, and I had an event going on in my family where I just had to get there. So I tried and tried and tried to get this engine started, and I essentially ground the battery down to the ground. Then I paralleled it with another battery with a good set of jumper cables. Boy, did I prove to myself that the starter motor on a 12-volt automobile is way too small to do the job. The whole philosophy is, under normal circumstances, you never grind the starter motor for more than, let's say, 10 seconds or so. So it really is a 2-volt motor being fed 12 volts. And despite its small size, it can turn out a tremendous amount of horsepower, but only for very brief periods of time. And here I am running in the starting motor mode with the two parallel car batteries into this poor starter motor for probably 120 seconds. And boy, did I burn that thing up something fierce. So I knew what I was doing at the time. I knew I was taking a lot of chance. So that's somewhat similar to what you ran into, although your case is not as extreme. But those are extreme cases. A heck of a lot of things with the right philosophy are very repairable, as Mel and I have found out. I've only had one horror story. Let me drop. And that was one particular ICOM radio for 450 megacycle, 450 all-mode radio. That whole production run, they did not wash off the rosin on the printed circuit board for the frequency synthesizer. And the frequency synthesizer contained a lot of integrated circuits and a lot of variable capacitors. And the highly active flux that was left on that board was eating its way through the integrated circuits and destroying the chips inside and eating its way through the bearing on the variable capacitors and destroying them. So that particular rig was a loser. But that's a rare case. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yeah, no doubt. I could say I've had also my, I never had 100% success, you know, with a lot of these radios that I picked up, because some of them, you know, you made a little sort of a funny remark there, but there are ones that have fallen from towers that are not quite salvageable. And I've had ones that really taken a tremendous beating, you know, lightning problems or whatever. But listen, you know, you take a shot at it. And, but I would say, I will say easily, I've been at least 85% successful. At least, I'll give it the benefit of doubt on secondhand radios, and got quite a number of them, and been successful in, you know, in resurrecting them. But yeah, I guess eBay sounds like a very good place to start to get an idea what the going price of that piece of equipment is at this point. Let me say one more thing. I don't think it pays if you're going to buy something that, you know, is, let's say, a year old or something, you know, and somebody decided that they either want to get something else, not happy with it, but it's in great condition, and you're going to have to give him close to exactly what they paid to purchase that item, and wind up, and at the same time, it is a secondhand piece of equipment, and the most likely the warranty is expired. I think if it's going to be that close, where I see a lot of equipment that they're asking basically the same price-wise as they paid, I think in that case, Dick, I suggest you, if you're going to keep the radio a number of years, it pays then to buy a brand new one over.
Yes, it does. There are also certain pieces of equipment, like Collins equipment, that people fall in love with, that has all kinds of great nostalgic value. And that piece of Collins equipment might sell today at close to or slightly above the price it sold to in that day when it was brand new. And that might be the going rate. Just a matter of, again, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. If it's a piece of equipment because of its nostalgic value, like Collins, people might pay considerably more than the brand new price then. And if you love it well enough, and if it, if eBay says that's the kind of price it's selling for, that's the going rate. So you don't always want to rate it as a percentage of the brand new price. My greatest criteria is, does it have a good reputation? Do I like it and love it enough? And is it the right price compared to a brand new, somewhat equivalent today? Then I'm willing to go for it. I paid some pretty high and some pretty low prices for equipment, and most of those cases I was very happy. For a man of your resources, Mel, the exact dollar value isn't always the main criteria. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Most definitely, this is K2KEY. No, it's not the point. Yes, with Collins, that's unique because it is a basically a collector's using it as an antique value. But there are a lot of people like myself that just don't want it sitting there, you know, looking good or as a conversation piece. I want it to be on the air. I use the Collins equipment. I use the KWS-1. I use 7584, I use the F-lines, I do put them on the air. And, you know, anybody else that says, my God, look at all the knobs you got to turn today, it's so easy, you push a button, blah, blah. Yes, true, 100% true. But, you know, I guess it's not appreciated by everybody, the antique radio such as Collins. It's not for everybody, but for certain people that appreciate or are collectors, it's another story. They will pay the price for a very good piece of Collins equipment that's in great shape because it's like automobiles, antique cars. It's condition. That's the bottom line, Dick. And the only thing I object to is when these manufacturers, like such as I had that situation with Kenwood, I had a run-in with them, I talked to them, and soured me on their product only because I think I was taking advantage of what they charged me for a power transformer over.
Nick.
I do understand that one. The automobile I'm now driving, 89 Toyota, I think it is. Yep. Camry, I think it is. I think it's the model number. When I bought it 2 years ago, I guess it was 8 years old, I think I paid $1,000 above Blue Book value at a used car dealer. But the machine itself was in extremely good shape, very clean, not very miles, many miles. I looked it up in the computer records and found out that those were the real miles. It had just the color that I liked. The fact that I paid more than Blue Book value didn't bother me. It was a hell of a lot cheaper than anything I could have bought of a brand new comparable size. And I again like used cars because I can maintain them. So there's many a person who wouldn't buy something because it's above Blue Book value. I only buy a car once every 10 years, and so the exact dollars I pay doesn't really matter when you amortize it over that many years. Do you want it bad enough? I did some negotiating. I could have done more, but I wanted it fast. The exact dollars didn't bother me that much. It's something I do that rarely. This is 11 o'clock, and I'm going to have to leave you guys. Quite possibly Mel and the group are going to continue for longer. That's their choice. This was TechNet number 1,231 of the series. That began in September 1982. On the assumption that Mel and I stay healthy, we'll be back next week, and Mel will probably continue, because I guarantee you got more in that mailbag. And also, one further warning I'm going to repeat again, and that is, let me drop the mailbag that Mel is answering. is above and beyond the call of duty. Mel and I have not promised to give a free written consultation.